Okay, so I guess we're live.
All right. Well, this is a good chapter. I'm looking forward to talking with you about it.
Oh, now I'm worried.
Hello. In this podcast, Randy and Jim talk about mathematical consistency, black body radiation, the Compton effect, uncertainty relationships, single slit diffraction, and the clock in the box paradox, as they continue their discussion of Yakir Aharonov and Daniel Rorlick's quantum paradox. This is Chapter 2, How to Weigh a Quantum.
Why? We got into some real quantum theory meat and potatoes here.
Gotta happen sometime.
So last time we talked about the nature of paradox and its role in science.
So was there anything about that you thought about?
No, I thought we did fine last week, right?
I thought we did okay, but we'll find out when we get comments, right?
That's right, from our fans. Our fans numbering in zero at this point.
We've got the modal number of fans for a show that hasn't actually gone up on the internet.
So what is the modal number of fans?
For a show that hasn't gone up?
Yeah.
Nobody's heard before?
That's right.
The modal number is zero.
That's what I thought. This is a good chapter. I guess it's a How to Weigh a Quantum.
What are your thoughts about the chapter in general?
Well, I think it's great. I mean, touches a little bit on the Einstein-Bohr debates about the validity of quantum theory.
Mm-hmm.
And it really showcases, I think, some terrific Einstein thought puzzle type of debate. I love the clock in a box at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Einstein was really brilliant at coming up with thought experiments to point out really the root of his thoughts on different subjects. And this is a great debate to see that, perhaps even the most classic debate, where you see scientists throwing thought experiments around and trying to solve them, and amazingly seeing how quantum theory could actually respond to all of them and resolve them.
This chapter is actually about a couple of ideas of Einstein that came earlier on in those debates. What Einstein wanted to talk about was whether or not quantum mechanics is
consistent.
Right. And later on, he switched to seeing whether or not it's complete, which is a different sort of mathematical idea. Consistency is another mathematical idea. I mean, it just means that if you take all those axioms of quantum mechanics, can you derive a contradiction? If you can't, then you have a consistent set of axioms. If you can derive a contradiction, then it's inconsistent. Inconsistency is probably the norm. You just grab seven postulates, probably a couple of those postulates will not work together with each other.
I love how there was a sort of an intuitively convincing series of arguments against the consistency of quantum theory that actually fell apart one after the other to prove its validity. That was pretty exciting.
Probably from these kind of arguments are where we get a lot of the intuition about quantum mechanics and a lot of the ways people try to understand it. And next chapter, I think we can talk about what happens with incompleteness and completeness of quantum theory, because we're not going to get into that. All of these thought experiments that Einstein's going to talk about this time, those are just against the idea that quantum mechanics is consistent.
Right, logically consistent. How can that be true?
Yeah, the real rationale behind them probably comes about because this is what they call the old quantum theory mostly. Right. So when they were just putting things together. And I mean a lot of this chapter is talking about things like that.
Right. The whole wave particle duality.
Yeah. It begins by talking about black body radiation, which is just, you know, what happens when you have a kiln or something and you heat it up really hot. It shows different colors. And that's where quantum mechanics got started. And it started with a contradiction. It started with this problem with the theories of electromagnetism.
And statistical mechanics.
Statistical mechanics and thermodynamics at that time. In just trying to solve that contradiction, Max Planck had to make a few postulates to justify an answer that is now a quantum idea, that energy transfers in little chunks.
Right.
In a particular system, you can only transfer an energy of a certain amount. Under that amount, you can't do it. In between little chunks of that amount, you can't do it. You get one of those little chunks at a time. And that chunk has to be some sort of discrete mode of the system.
It's basically like saying that reality isn't analog, it's digital, right?
In a way, except, of course, the energies are interpreted as frequencies of waves, right? So so if you're going to say you have digital waves, I guess.
Well, it's like pixelation, right? Like there's a pixel of this color, and then you can't get a color between that one and the next one because there has to be a step of a certain size. So it's like there's a mesh kind of quality to reality.
Yeah.
And that's interesting. Why is it that Planck's constant is the size that it is? You know, do we have any idea why energy has this discrete quality where you can only get certain steps of energy from one wavelength to the next?
Why it has a discrete quality like
that? Yeah. Why is Planck's unit that number? Do we have any idea why energy wants to exist in those discrete steps?
Yeah, I don't think there's any real derivation of Planck's constant. I think that comes from experiment.
Mm-hmm. But there has to be a reason for it, right?
There has to be a reason for it, and we don't have it.
Note to self, derive Planck's constant.
That's right. If somebody had a theory that actually derived that number from first principles without having to move around a lot of numbers nobody can measure.
We'd have learned something very fundamental about reality, right?
That's right.
At least about light.
About reality, because Planck's constant isn't just about light.
It also extends to the Heisenberg uncertainty principle.
All of the uncertainty principles have to do with that, and that has to do with every elementary particle. So that means that everything in the universe is in some way related to Planck's constant.
I thought it was intriguing that Einstein was such an adversary against quantum theory in years following his work on the photoelectric effect, which won him the Nobel Prize.
I don't think he was against quanta, right? He just saw a lot of what was going on as sort of mystical. You know, that whole Copenhagen interpretation thing is a little bit mystical in some way. You have a system, and it does either this or it does that. And you can say it does this, you can say it does that, but you can't say what's happening in between.
Well, he was looking for logical contradictions to prove that the theory was flawed.
Yeah, because it doesn't make sense. But that's what Chapter 9 is about.
But what's interesting is that all of the things that he was debating about with the uncertainty relationship with mm-hmm. Bohr, they all derived directly from the same constant that he employed with E equals Planck's constant times the frequency. He likes E equals equations, it seems.
Energy is fundamental. But I think a lot of it comes about with what they had available at the time. A lot of the stuff that Aharonov and Rohrlich are talking about, that's Bohr
responding to
Einstein and using the uncertainty principle to say, what you say you can do, you cannot do.
Right.
Right. So Einstein would be looking at, you know, this wave-particle duality and saying, okay, I've got this wave phenomenon, but I can use the particle part to figure out something that's going on in this intermediate step, and that will give me more information than you say I can get. And then Bohr comes in and says, well, if I analyze it this way with the uncertainty principle, all of that wave information then disappears.
This story certainly shows you the benefit of coming under heavy fire from a brilliant mind, because it allowed Bohr to pretty much lay the foundations for quantum theory.
Pretty much, yeah.
Nice.
So,
because it was worth the anxiety of having Einstein come at you with one great thought experiment after another. I love the reaction that Bohr had when he was confronted with the clock in a box paradox, the crushing terror and anxiety as he flitted around the room talking to different physicists, trying to figure out where Einstein had missed something.
Well,
it can't be true. if Einstein's right, it's the end of physics. It'll be the end of physics if Einstein's right. I would love to pose a question one day that would make some brilliant physicists shriek in alarm that it would be the end of all that we can know if I'm right. I was thinking while I was reading this chapter how much I wish there was that type of fertile adversarial environment in physics today. Every once in a while, you'll hear about a paradox or some conundrum that has theoretical physicists chomping at the bit and staying up late and sharpening their pencils. But we're not making the kind of strides that they were making back then. You know, 100 years ago, physics was changing year by year. It seems like we've kind of reached a stasis point to some extent where there haven't been many major theoretical breakthroughs in a long time. It must have been an exciting time.
After a QCD, there hasn't been anything that was really strong and amazing.
The biggest headlines in physics for the last few decades seems like they've been proving these arguments from the 30s and 40s. We finally found and detected this effect that we never thought we'd be able to prove, right? A lot of looking back.
Oh, there are a lot of those. But a lot of those are important. A lot of those turn into a lot of technological inventions, right?
Sure.
Doing a lot of good work on that, things along that nature. It's not as cool as having these two brilliant guys arguing all the time.
Intellectual boxing match. Yeah, we need more of that.
You know, we can put it on cable.
Like, there was Hawking. Was it Hawking and Lee Smolin that were debating the loss of information in the black hole?
So let's see. What interesting things have we got? So we've got the black body.
Let's look at that. Oh, there was one part here where he's looking at the equation Rayleigh and Jeans came up with. And he was saying that can't be true because if you integrate that, it diverges. What exactly is he saying there?
That means there's an infinite amount of energy in the universe.
Oh. Okay.
There's an infinite amount of energy in the kiln, even. Because when you try to integrate from low...
Oh, I see. There's an infinite number of steps, therefore there's an infinite number of energy
there's no low. Yeah, there's no lowest spot there.
Right.
And that's going to be the biggest thing, is since there's no lowest energy shift, then you have to add in the bits from each part. But that function is such that when you try to do that integral, you end up with an infinite number.
So
it's okay for it to go to infinity, as long as when you do the integral isn't infinite.
Right.
But when you add up all the energies, it's infinite only at an infinitesimal spot, and it goes towards infinity at a small enough rate. Then when you add the little infinite part in, multiplied by a little infinitesimal size, that little point is zero, and then everything adds up fine. Mathematicians are going to hate me for saying that. But if that rate that it's going towards infinity is too steep, then when you try to add in that infinitesimal point, that's infinite.
Okay.
It's also possible to end up with those two things just balancing out, just a number.
Okay.
But mostly it's one of those two. You have your differential area, your differential width, and your differential height are such that you have zero or you have infinity.
Well, Planck's constant doesn't seem to put an upper limit on frequency, but it seems like it implies a lower limit on frequency. Is there a smallest wavelength of light?
Right. If you had a different sized kiln, then you'd have a different spectrum. And if you have a different spectrum, that means this fundamental frequency that everything's transferring at is a different frequency.
I thought that what he was saying here was that the size of the kiln only matters for the total energy content, but that the energy density, and therefore the spectrum, would be the same no matter what size the kiln was. I think that's what he was saying somewhere here.
As far as I know, you don't interpret that as having a smallest frequency for light, although I guess logically it has to be one.
Because of Planck's constant.
Because you can't get lower than zero.
But if Planck's constant says that energy comes in discrete steps, then from zero to the first step has to be a discrete unit, right?
For a particular system. It doesn't have to be the same. It doesn't have to be the same for every system. If you have photons of a certain frequency in a system, that's going to be the step.
Okay, so that's why we can observe photons at any frequency, regardless of steps,
mm-hmm.
because it only applies to the system that emits it?
Basically, there are characteristic frequencies for each bit of matter, right?
Right.
Those discrete frequencies and from geometrical resonances and things like that. So Planck's solution was just assuming that you had all of these oscillators that were based on the system, and he was assuming that you had oscillators for your thermal properties as well. That's not much of a jump. Fourier had already analyzed heat in terms of, you know, sines and cosines and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
When he developed Fourier analysis, it was in a book called The Analytical Theory of Heat. And even today we think of phonons as sort of second quantized particles in matter.
Lattice.
And those are really just little oscillators, and they act just like any other quantum mechanical particle, only they're stuck in a material.
Right.
So he had both of those two reasonable things there. The only unreasonable thing was where he decided we've got this sort of minimum frequency, and it's only in steps of this minimum frequency that we can transfer energy from the thermal system to the electromagnetic system, and the electromagnetic system being the light emitted or the light radiated from the black body.
It seems like the entire field of quantum physics owes its thanks to that moment when Planck formulated Planck's law, and he went past the harmonic oscillator part.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that additional excitation energy would require a higher frequency.
Mm-hmm.
So he basically invented the idea of quanta, mm-hmm. right then and there, and codified it in that equation. That was a brilliant leap and a crazy leap. And he said somewhere in here that, yeah, it was an act of desperation. I had to obtain a positive result under any circumstance and at whatever cost. So somehow, out of total terror that he wasn't going to find an answer,
mm-hmm.
he came up with some crazy idea, and it birthed the entire field.
Actually, I meant to sneak out and figure out what his situation was at that point, and I did not.
But that would be a good historical thing. You know, the rent was overdue. His girlfriend, his wife, was getting impatient with him. You've got to get back to farming. Something like that was going on in his life, I guess. He sounded pretty desperate.
But nobody paid much attention to it. People said, okay, well, this is what's going on in this system, and we can still interpret that classically. We don't really understand why the energy transfer is in these discrete lumps, but there's no reason to make any big deal about it. It's not really until Einstein gets to the photoelectric effect and he uses it in another system that people say, this is amazing.
So the jump from using quantum theory to describe a black body problem,
mm-hmm.
Einstein took that and said, No, the same idea applies to the emission of electrons out of metals when it's hit with light.
And this is what happens in science, is that you use some idea to help describe one particular experiment. That's nice, but we don't really understand why it's done that. But when you get to the point where you use that idea for a completely unrelated experiment, rather than a ceramic kiln and just thermal excitations, now you're looking at actually producing electric currents
right.
from shining a light on something. Now, all of a sudden, this one idea is really important because it's obviously a general idea.
Right.
It's really something, it's something that should be applied to all sorts of things.
The Compton effect came up shortly after that. They talk here vaguely about a bouncing light off of free electrons. Mm-hmm. Could you describe that experiment a little bit more so I can get my teeth into it? What does that mean? Where did he have the free electrons? Were they accumulated on a charged plate or something like that?
I'm not exactly sure where he got these electrons and what he was doing with that. But that is interesting, because what basically is going on is you have this electron and you have this photon, and they hit each other. You know, they transfer momentum. And that's the whole reason why he put this in here, was to mention that on top of having energy, the photon has momentum.
So when these two impact, instead of having a nice, smooth possibility of trajectories, there's mm-hmm. a discrete series of angles that they can reflect off of each other because the energy is and the momentum is quantized.
The effect depended on the frequency of the light.
Right, but that was quantized, so that's yeah. why he was noticing specific angles were discretely coming out.
Yes, you'd get these particular angles. For an electromagnetic wave, for a wave in general, if you increase the amplitude, you have more energy in it.
Mm-hmm.
That makes plenty of sense. But when these electrons and photons hit each other, the electrons always went in the same angle that was based on the frequency of the light, not on the amplitude.
Right.
And so what that implies is that the amplitude is just a number of discrete particles. And so no matter how many times you hit one of these electrons, you only hit one photon with one electron at one time. You use the energy from that one photon, and all those other photons, it doesn't really matter because they're not part of that collision.
I guess a crude analogy that comes to mind is if you're banging on a drum,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't matter how many times you hit the drum with a certain amount of force, you're not going to break it. You need a higher frequency, you need a higher energy with a strike in order to break the drum, in order to free that electron. Is that an apt analogy?
Mm-hmm, probably not.
Probably not? But doesn't it take that photon having more energy in order to cause the electron to escape?
Yeah, it's the change in the energy of the photon when
it
you change
more
the frequency.
And it hits harder.
But, I mean, with the drum, if you raise your hand higher, even if you can do it at the same speed, that's where your energy is going to come from, is by hitting harder.
Right, I guess
so,
I was sticking more to the momentum thing. Like, if you hit it with a certain amount of force each time, it's not going to break, no matter how many times you hit it that force.
Yeah, so I guess if you know, you hit really fast with small hits, that's true. I'm not, probably it won't break because, you know, it's going to relax well in time for you to hit it again. But
so I'm just
going to
come up with dumb thought models like this to help bring it, bring it home so in a way that I can understand it intuitively. I'm sure that'll certainly fail because I'm trying to make sense of quantum mechanics and that's how those things go.
It's kind of unfortunate that he doesn't do more with the Compton effect, because the Compton effect, I think the way it works,
he's saying here, scattering electrons, light off of electrons at rest.
Mm-hmm.
And he's saying about imparting momentum in an amount that depends on the wavelength, but not on its intensity.
The thing that I recall from the Compton effect is that rather than having this thing where you have a photon and an electron, they hit and they go off and do other things, there are lots of different ways to have it. One of them is a photon comes around, he splits into an electron and a positron.
Mm-hmm.
The positron then hits the electron, and that creates the new electron. So this second thing that I just said is completely equivalent to the first thing. Well, maybe it's not equivalent, but these are two different ways to get the same effect. And to actually calculate this, you have to include this one where we have this positron and electron showing up out of nowhere, basically this electron decomposing into these two particles.
You mean the photon decomposing
into the electron and the positron, and then the positron
interacting with the electron,
hitting the other electron that was just coming out of nowhere, and that becomes a photon again. And so,
a neutrino emission or anything in that interaction?
No, I don't think there's a neutrino emission in this interaction. I think there can't be, because otherwise you couldn't have both of these particles.
Okay.
When you figure out the probability of the Compton effect happening, you have to include all of the possibilities where the photon turns into a positron and an electron, both before and after the event. So you have to add in all of those different possibilities. It's really odd, and it's really fun if you're looking at this on a Feynman diagram, you can look at the path in that interesting way where your electron bounces back in time to bounce back forward in time. So if you start off with a photon and an electron,
right,
and going to end with a photon and an electron that have scattered off of each other. But you can also look at it as, in the interim, the electron has moved forward in time, emitted a photon.
Right, and recoiled back in time.
Coiled back in time as a positron, and then hit that original photon and then gone back forward in time. So this is the sort of thing that led Feynman's speculation that there could only be one electron in the universe.
Well, couldn't the same be said of a photon?
Well, no, because it goes away.
But it continues here.
If you interpret this way, there is no photon from the point where the electron and positron split off to the point where the electron and positron annihilate.
So it ceases to exist during the time the positron's moving backwards in time.
We're already at the point where we're talking about things gets a little bit weird.
Well, I like weird. Is this one of those things where you can have a positron moving backward in time for a very small amount of time?
I'm not completely sure. Because you can look at this without looking at it as the positron being an electron going backwards in time.
Right.
You can look at it instead as the photon provides the energy to create a positron and an electron. If you don't look at it in Feynman's view, it doesn't seem that weird. Although it still seems a little bit weird, but it doesn't seem as weird as it could have seemed.
Well, it seems plenty strange enough. Have we got a clear answer yet on whether positrons are electrons moving backward in time?
Yeah, I don't think anybody really believes it.
Is there any reason not to believe that?
There aren't enough positrons.
But does that address the question of whether a positron is a backward moving electron?
Generally, because assume there are lots and lots and lots of electrons running around. So if there's only one electron, the matter-antimatter asymmetry would be something that would say that's not true. I just haven't heard anybody seriously put that forward. Right. At some point, you have to say, what does that mean? If it acts like a positively charged electron moving forward in time, then probably that's what it is.
I see. And because this Feynman diagram that includes that backward moving time component can be interpreted as just a simple reflection like this.
It's just one component of this kind of reflection scheme.
Okay. I like those little departures off into the abstract.
Anyways, I think that more or less gets us through why photons have to be little particles. And I think that's probably the reason why Aharonov and Rohrlich went through that entire talk about black body radiation. Other than it looks like an example of a contradiction, I don't think it really helps very much with things as they build up. It's background, mm-hmm. Right?
Okay.
Then he talks about uncertainty relationships. I'm not sure. Do you want to go into detail about the microscope? Just uses the example of a microscope, the uncertainty of relationships.
I actually thought that was a really nice and elegant way to show the reader the intuitive quality of the uncertainty relationship.
Mm-hmm.
The position and momentum thing can seem a little abstract. It was nice to see an example where it seems intuitively obvious that, sure, if you get a photon, and the photons we now know have momentum, and it has a discrete amount of momentum that's going to introduce into the system in order to make your observation, mm-hmm. then of course it's interacting with that system, and the amount of that momentum is going to create an uncertainty in what you're looking at, what's mm-hmm. position and momentum is. So that was a really nice and intuitive explanation, I thought.
So basically, every microscope has this diffraction limit, and you can't resolve anything below that.
Diffraction limit is just a fancy term for how precisely you can see something at a certain scale, right?
Your microscope has a limit to how much
it can resolve.
The resolution.
Okay.
And that means because visible light is a narrow spectrum,
right,
somewhere around 1 micrometer or something like that, you can't get any more resolution with any optical microscope. Mm-hmm. That's why he did this. This is something that's actually pretty normal. I didn't know it was normal until later on because it wasn't really presented well to me as an undergraduate. And I think that's probably because we didn't get far enough in our mechanics book. This shows up in books on mechanics. When you start getting into collective oscillations and things like that, you can derive uncertainty relationships.
Well, I thought this was really beautiful too, because it goes from there to using the uncertainty principle to actually showing you how you derive the distance between those waves in the interference pattern.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was also really nice and intuitive, really mechanical. You can get your head around that.
It's a really good way to talk about what's going on with these interference patterns as well. And introduce this whole idea of complementarity, that you have these conjugate variables like position and momentum, and you can only measure them to some precision. You can't measure both of them to some precision less a certain number, which is Planck's constant.
The idea of conjugate variables first seems kind of abstract, but then you realize that with any given system, you're going to have quantities which are interrelated
yeah.
fundamentally.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way to isolate one of those variables from the other one, and no matter what experiment you run.
Yeah.
So that shed some light, too, on the uncertainty principle.
Yeah, and so the only difference here between quantum mechanics and classical mechanics is that quantum mechanics says that there's a fundamental limit to that.
Right.
Not just an experimental limit to that. Because otherwise, when you do all of this work,
right.
you can find a experimental limit for any given experiment. And
right.
then you say, okay, what can I do with my experiment to improve on that?
Right.
And for a lot of experiments, you know, that number is much, much larger than Planck's constant.
Sure.
It's only when you spend a lot of work trying to get everything out of the experiment, getting all the vibrations out and things like that, you can get to a point where Planck's constant is your limiting problem.
And the example you used here was, I thought, a good one, the hydrogen radius mm-hmm. of an electron around a hydrogen nucleus. And showing mathematically how the lowest energy photon that can interact with that electron going around the hydrogen atom in a ground state is enough energy to ionize it. So of course you're not going to be able to observe where that reflected from,
mm-hmm.
as it's going to bounce off of it in some random direction as it escapes from the hydrogen, right?
And there are lots of these uncertainty relationships because there are lots of conjugate variables. We just talked about the position and momentum. Another one we'll look at a lot is the energy-time uncertainty relationship. How well you can measure when something happened is sort of dependent on how well you can measure the change in energy of the state.
That's when it gets into the clock-in-the-box paradox.
And the clock-in-the-box paradox is the first thing that we're going to see where that's actually used.
Right.
But that's going to come up again and again and again and again. In part, that's because that uncertainty relationship is kind of difficult to interpret. One of these chapters, I think, is just trying to figure out how to interpret these numbers. Delta E is not too difficult, right? The change in energy is not too difficult. But what is this change in time? That's more difficult to interpret.
Right.
And so one of these chapters, he's got a paradox that's going to focus in on just trying to understand this energy-time uncertainty relationship.
Well, before we get into the clock-in-the-box paradox, it occurred to me that while I was reading through all the uncertainty, all of the uncertainty relations in these examples trace directly to the energy and momentum of photons and their quantized nature, right?
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was interesting because it made me think, well, if there was some other kind of particle that didn't have that relationship of energy and momentum, if there was some imaginary particle that didn't have momentum and you could run experiments with that, would you observe these uncertainty relations?
If it didn't have momentum.
I mean, if you just tried to create some kind of imaginary particle that could reflect off an electron without disturbing its orbit significantly, would we be able to know the position of that electron? Momentum.
Well, I mean, according to quantum mechanics, you wouldn't be able to.
But isn't quantum mechanics tying the photon in with the observed matter so that it's part of a system and that's why we end up with these things?
In general, people think that it's a more fundamental thing than that. So these paradoxes all occur because we're looking at a small system with the large system, and at some point they interact. And if you ignore what's happening at that interaction point, then you have a problem.
But isn't the interaction point in all of these experiments basically the photon? Because it's got to interact with the system to get us the information that we're looking
for?
Well,
no, I think he actually uses, for these interference things, that's using electrons.
Right, but electrons have the same momentum and energy uncertainty, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
everything has the same momentum, energy, uncertainty relationship.
Right, but that's...
So if you said you had something that had no momentum, then it would have no uncertainty in its momentum. And so if it actually acted like a quantum mechanical particle, you'd never have any idea where it was.
Hmm.
You could never find it.
Hmm. Okay.
Because its uncertainty in its position would have to be infinite.
I wonder if that's... There's an unparticle physics that I heard about one time where they talked about particles that weren't located physically in any given spot but were everywhere at once. But that's a whole other... Maybe someday we'll...
Unparticle physics.
Yeah.
I have enough trouble with particle physics.
I did have one question, though, that I wanted to raise. If you have a single slit and mm-hmm. you pass electrons or photons through it, there's no interference pattern, right? It just...
There is an interference pattern. So there is a single slit interference.
For a single slit, there's an interference pattern.
There is. It's a lot wider, and I think it has a little bit different rationale. If you have a narrow slit, there is going to be an interference pattern. A normal undergraduate course in physics, at some point, you're going to play with wave interference, right? You're going to take a laser, you're going to shine it through some little slits, and you're going to observe what happens.
Right.
And the first thing you have to do is you have to look at the single slit and see what's happening there. In that case, you have this really broad intensity peak, first intensity peak, and then some smaller ones that keep on going. It's just that most of the time, you don't see all those trailing waves.
You only
see the part that has an intensity above what your eye can actually see. So you see a point.
Okay.
And if you have a really intense thing like a laser, then you can see a couple of these points on the edge.
Okay.
But a lot of times the central thing is so large that you can't see those other...
It blots out the little ones.
And the reason why you do that is because when you do the double slit experiment, the double slit, you know, has a lot of these wave peaks. And technically, they should go on forever and ever and ever. But because of the single slit experiment, they don't go on forever and ever and ever. They're basically superimposed on top of the single slit diffraction thing. So instead, the central peak is a lot brighter than the edge peaks as they go out. And you don't see it peaks coming out forever.
Is it possible that that interference pattern is a product of the particles interacting with the matter of the material the slits cut in? I mean, we know that an electron has a field, which is basically infinite. Could that field be interacting with the electrons in the material to throw it off in a different direction?
I don't think so. Both of these can be completely explained by wave optics.
Okay.
In fact, the double slit experiment is the reason why people thought that light was a wave in the first place, is because of Thomas Young's experiments. We're basically able to see these interference patterns, which would be just like what happens if you throw two rocks into a pond and let the waves propagate out from there. So he was able to see these coming from the sun, because that was the only place where he had polarized light to use. And that was the experiment that showed that light was electromagnetic wave.
So one pinhole was enough for him to detect those ripples. He didn't have two.
I think he had two pinholes. Right?
Okay.
And I think he did it, what he really probably had was something very much like set up for the interference patterns here, right?
Right.
You have all of this light coming down this giant columnated chimney, and then at the end of the chimney, he puts in just a single slit that'll have the light coming out in a long line, so that when it gets some far distance away, everything that actually hits the double slit have almost the same direction. And then when it goes from the double slit to the screen, you get these wave effects. That's how all of these double slit experiments are going to work.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's why he has the single slit and then the double slit and then the interference pattern.
Well,
the
single slit is to is
that's
just
to your light source, so you know they're all going the same direction.
That's right. And we're going to see a lot of interference experiments. In this particular case, he does use the interference of light to draw a paradox.
So the clock in the box paradox, that's the most exciting part of this whole chapter. It's right here towards the end. So let's look at that. That's a fun experiment.
Okay, so how do you understand the clock-in-the-box paradox?
Well, Einstein had posed this as a challenge to Bohr, and he said that if you have a box suspended from a spring, and you let it settle so that with a fine positioning arrow so that you could see exactly where it was oriented, and then if you emitted a photon out of that box, because energy has a certain amount of mass, the box would be a little bit lighter, and it would rise up and it would bounce on this spring until it reached a new equilibrium position at some distant point in the future. And so then you could see how much lighter the box was to an arbitrarily precise degree. And the idea was that inside the box there's a clock which registers the time that the photon is emitted, so that long after the fact you will know the exact time and the exact mass of the photon, which would violate the uncertainty relation. Is that right?
Yeah, that's pretty much exactly what he said.
Okay, so Bohr was shocked and horrified to be faced with this paradox at a conference because he didn't see anything wrong with it at first, and he had to sleep on it. But I guess the next day, probably under the pressure that he's got his peers waiting for him to come up with a response the next day at the conference, he has pretty brilliant insight. He realizes that there's an uncertainty to start with on the position of the box, and that because the position of the box depends on the gravitational field gradient of the Earth, that means that there's going to be a time dilation uncertainty within the box. So the rate of time within the box is going to incur a certain amount of uncertainty, and that this uncertainty over time, even over the arbitrarily long time that Einstein gives him for the box to reach its next position, is basically additive, so that you can never know the exact original and ending position and time of the experiment. And he proves it precisely to verify the uncertainty principle. Derivations lead exactly to the uncertainty principle in the end, once time dilation is accounted for. And in doing so, he invokes Einstein's own principle of equivalence between inertial mass and gravitational mass, and the time dilation equations of general relativity to come back to Einstein with this proof. And that is the tipping point, as I understand it, for Einstein, where he decided, okay, it does appear to be logically consistent. Now I'm going to have to see if quantum theory is complete.
I mean, I don't even see why you need me. You can just do these on your own now.
I think I missed something. But
the only thing that I wasn't clear on there is that this particular particular paradox, rather than talking about the wave-particle duality, like most of the other paradoxes that we've seen so far, and most of the things that looked like Einstein was worried about prior to this, this particular paradox actually attacked the energy-time uncertainty principle.
Right, we're looking at energy and time here instead of momentum and position.
So it went directly at the energy-time uncertainty principle. So when Bohr was doing all this, what first he was able to relate changing the energy to a change in the momentum.
Right.
And somewhere in there, he gets the gravitational, because you have a change in the height of the thing, so that's a change in your gravitational potential energy.
Right.
Then he relates the change in the time to the change in the position, and that's where you're talking about using Lorentz transformations.
Right.
And yeah, then he just zips on through, does a little bit of mathematics, and bang, you have the energy-time uncertainty relationship. It's not like it came out of nowhere, right? He still assumed the position-momentum uncertainty relationship. If he hadn't done that, he would have actually derived Planck's constant, and we wouldn't have said what we said at the beginning of the show. But he was able to save the energy-time uncertainty relationship with the position of momentum uncertainty relationship, special relativity, I think, and a little bit of freshman physics.
You know, what I love about this paradox in this story is that I think Einstein could have figured out the solution to his own paradox if he'd been motivated to do it. But he was out to try to poke a hole in this model of quantum theory. And so he just devised this incredibly clear and challenging paradox for Bohr to face. And so it was Bohr's job to find the answer. But I love how the confrontational nature of science in this case, it just shows you it's human nature to want your own ideas to be true. In this case, Einstein wanted a classical model of reality. And if he had to shoot holes in all of Bohr's ideas about quantum theory to do it, then he was out to do it. And so he created this terrific little bomb in the form of a clock in a box.
Yeah.
And so Bohr was the one motivated. But I think that if Einstein had been on the other side of the fence, and if Bohr had been the one saying, no, this uncertainty can't be true, then Einstein probably could have answered his own puzzle there. Is that interesting? Do physicists try to do that? When you come up with a paradox and you want to challenge somebody's ideas, do you ever sit down and go, now, if I was looking at this from the other side, how would I refute it?
Well, yeah, I don't know. Most of the time when I've been around physicists, people have been a lot more helpful than confrontational. There are some people out there that tend to be confrontational, but they don't always tend to be the people that you really would listen to.
Well, when I say confrontational, I think I mean it in the friendly sense. I would think that Bohr and Einstein probably had tremendous respect for each other. Maybe I'm wrong there. I'm not sure what their personal relationship was like, but I'd think that after going through a few rounds of a good row like this, they'd end up with a lot of respect for each other and see this is more of like a personal challenge to rise to the occasion than a, you know, I'm gonna do the end of your career right now because I want to see you starve on the street. I don't think there is a hostility to it, but I do like the example because it just shows how scientists do a great job challenging each other on their conclusions and ideas. I think that there's a little bit too much of an ivory tower external perception that scientists are all kind of working together and they're all in some big club and they don't really test each other's ideas and they don't listen to the broader spectrum. But this is a great case where you see, you know, people going for the truth and they're taking off the gloves, and if there's a hole in the thinking, they're going to find it.
Thanks for listening to Randy and Jim on physicsfm.com. We've talked a lot about a lot of complex stuff, so if you have any questions at all, please feel free to comment wherever I have comments enabled. I've provided some links for books that we've mentioned in the podcast today, and maybe one or two other popular books that might be helpful to you. Please go ahead and look at those, buy them if you think it's a good thing. Right now, we don't have any other way to recoup our money on this. So if you could help us out that way, that would be great. Thanks for listening. Bye now. Okay, so I think that's what I've got today. It's about time to call my wife, so...
Fantastic. All right. Sorry for dragging it on, but I like our tangents.